are Radio Catskill.
Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. And I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me this evening. We got a lot of news to get to tonight. And by the way, have you noticed spring is pretty much here? This weekend marks the return of many local businesses, events, and activities. Things are already starting to jump, and that includes at the Borscht Belt Museum in Ellenville. Borscht Belt Museum reopening its doors for the season with an open house this Sunday. Coming up, we talk to Andrew Jacobs about the Borscht Belt Museum and what they've got in store for us this season, as well as details on the open house. They're going to have a little nosh. We'll tell you all about it. But first, it's time to do what we usually do on a Thursday, which is get the latest local news. From the Times Union, for that, we turn to the Times Union's Philip Pantuso, Hudson Valley. Philip, welcome back to the local edition.
Always good to be with you.
So let's start off with Hudson Valley Congressman Mike Lawler's town hall. I heard it was an energetic evening.
Energetic is one word for it, yeah. So on Sunday night in Clarkstown at Clarkstown South High School, Congressman Mike Lawler had his first town hall of this congressional term. And we were looking forward to this for a couple of reasons. One, he's one of the last people, at least in the Times Union's coverage area, to hold an in-district town hall this year. And two, and sort of more importantly for context here, town halls, these congressional town halls really across the country have seen high turnout and a lot of energy, as you put it. At Democratic events, many people have expressed anger about President Trump's actions, demanding more resistance, although a somewhat notable exception to that was Congressman Pat Ryan's town hall a couple of months ago in Poughkeepsie, where he was generally greeted with favor. And on the other side of the aisle, Republicans have faced protests, hard questions, and a lot of ire about the scope and the pace of action in Washington, particularly around cuts that are made by the Trump administration and the so-called Department of Government Efficiency and the local effects of those cuts. And some of those have been so unpleasant for the Republicans that House Speaker Mike Johnson has actually suggested that Republicans not hold these events at all. And I would say that Lawler's town hall on Sunday was more in the latter camp. So, you know, it's a couple things worth noting here. He won. His district is a swing district. It's flipped back and forth a couple of times in the last decade or so. But he won quite handily last November by, I think it was, final margin was something like 7 or 8% over Mondaire Jones, who was seen as a real challenger to him because he had represented the district previously. So we thought, okay, this is a district that isn't a deep red district. The crowd there might not be completely in the bag for everything that's happening on the federal level. But Lawler has been one of the few Republicans, I'd argue, in Congress who's been willing to stick his neck out a little bit against Trump. And so, you can tell in almost all of his public statements, all his public actions, he's trying to walk this line that few Republicans are able to balance between, staying in office essentially and delivering for his conservative base, but not also going full MAGA, let's say, but not going so anti-MAGA that he then draws the ire from Trump. So it's tough for him anyway. And yeah. On Sunday, he began by trying to project a sort of apolitical message crafted to appeal to constituents in the swing district, both sides of the aisle, by saying, "We are a strong, united country, And immediately the crowd there began to laugh at him.
Yeah, and that's where your reporter, Lana Bellamy, opens the article with that. And I actually have that moment here to play for the listener right now.
Let's hear it.
And the fact is that we as a country, whether people like the outcome of an election or not, the fact is that we are a strong, united country. And we have.
So there you go. That was what you were just talking about.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, another moment that we thought was pretty telling is that even before Lawler took the stage, or at least took the mic, the moderators there, which was Orangetown Supervisor Teresa Kenney and the Ramapo Deputy Supervisor Brendan Logan Charles, tried to lay down the rules of decorum, and they were sort of shouted down by people. They had to sort of shout back over the crowd. There were some sort of cheers and jeers even during the Pledge of Allegiance, which prompted Lawler to ask the crowd, please tell me you're not objecting to the Pledge of Allegiance. And this basically just continued. There was, there were lots of cheers, jeers, shrieks, howls coming from the audience. At times, Lawler would sort of stop and let it die down. Other times, he engaged and sort of bit back. There were protesters as well. The night before the town hall, Fox News actually reported that Indivisible Rockland, a progressive advocacy group in Rockland County, had organized a big protest that didn't seem to really, I think a couple of protesters got inside, but it didn't seem to really disrupt things too much ahead of time. But yeah, by the end of the event, he was apparently a hoarse from responding back and having to raise his voice over and over again to get over the cheers and jeers.
Yeah.
But he did say a couple of things that are worth noting, more substantive on a policy level, which I can talk about briefly.
Yeah, well, let's hear. I'm going to play one more clip just of like crowd reaction to some of what he's saying, and then I want to hear some of the points that he raised, and I've got a couple of questions too. But here's another moment from the town hall.
Taxing the rich is not going to close our budget. It really will not. It really will not. What, let me ask you a question. What rate would you propose? What rate?
So there you go. That's more from there. And, he starts actually trying to get in some policy positions there. And the crowd's responding even more strongly. So what were some of the points he was trying to make?
Yeah, so a couple of things he said that and this is something that most Republicans have said, that they do not support cuts to Medicaid for eligible recipients, which is, the spending bill that Republicans are trying to push through has such severe cuts that that experts who look at these things say there's no way to actually get to that number without cutting Medicaid. So no one's really been able to square that circle yet. But nevertheless, he said he did not support cuts to Medicaid recipients. He defended the use of vaccines. Which is, I guess qualifies maybe as a bold stance given the Health and Human Services Secretary's iffy position on vaccines, let's say. And he also called for a 10% tax on endowments at wealthy universities. And then also on the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, the El Salvador native who folks I'm sure have heard about in the news, who was accidentally deported along with a number of other people in the country illegally and some people who seem to have been in the country on green cards to that notorious terrorist prison in El Salvador. Lawler said that the Trump administration should comply with the court order to bring Garcia back and enter him into a proper sort of court proceeding, give him really the due process he was denied when he was initially deported. And he said that if the Trump administration did not do that, then, the courts should say that they're in contempt.
Wow. Well, this is the moment that we're at. I'm looking at the article here too, and there's a moment where, you know, a woman from the crowd kind of yelled out about, you know, why is the government cut Medicare? And Lawler interrupted to say there have been no cuts to Medicare, and if you're going to say something demonstrably false, I'm going to correct it. So it sounds like there was like a lot of back and forth there, but I can imagine there wasn't much that he could say in the end. Or would say in the end that would appeal or to this crowd or appease their anger.
Yeah, and you know, I don't think I said this yet, but there were we estimate there were about 700 people there. So, you know, a really big crowd. He's up there, you know, essentially by himself. The way that they were asking questions was people were asked to submit their questions ahead of time, and then they were written down and they were put into sort of like rotating drum and they would pull the questions out. This is why I think House Speaker Mike Johnson suggested Republicans not go to these things, especially when they're so big. They just turn into these shouting matches. That said, you know, he is an elected representative, and I would argue that it's important to actually face your constituents and answer their questions and make your policy points known. So, you know,
it's important to note too. Yeah, me too. I was going to say it's important to point out that he did just that, you know, and so good on him for that. It would be unfair of me to ask you, what do you think what the political implications of this are electorally in our region? So I'll ask you another unfair question. Has anybody been talking in the region about the political implications of a town hall like this?
I mean, there's a lot of conversation about Congressman Lawler right now. He's, you know, he's seen as kind of a rising star in the Republican Party. He has been heavily touted as a potential challenger to Governor Kathy Hochul next year when the governor's race in the state begins. And there are already a couple of Democrats who have been lining up to run for this seat in the midterm elections next fall, including a Rockland County legislator and an Army veteran. So, yeah, there's a lot of attention being paid to him on both sides of the aisle right now.
Okay. Well, thank you for bringing us that report. And I want to also thank Jesse King, who is the Hudson Valley Bureau Chief for WAMC, our news partners in New York Public News Network, for that audio I was able to play there. Philip, so see what else we can get to here. But there's the whole issue about New York allowing migrants to obtain driver's licenses. And now the federal level of government is weighing in on this, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So this is an update on a story that's been playing out for a couple of months now. I can't remember if I've talked about it or not, but New York has a law that allows migrants to obtain driver's license. It's commonly known as the Green Light Law. And a month or two, a couple of months ago, the Trump administration sued to try to overturn that law. And they're specifically kind of coming at a provision of it that prohibits immigration enforcement agencies from accessing motor vehicle records and driver databases. Essentially, you know, as a way to find immigrants who might be in the country illegally. The state attorney general's office here in New York filed a motion saying that it should be dismissed. And this week, the Department of Justice has asked a federal judge to issue what's called a declaratory judgment saying that the law is unconstitutional and to issue an order prohibiting state officials from enforcing it. So, you know, it doesn't take a genius to surmise why they're doing this. They say so as much in their court filings. They say that this prohibits federal immigration officials from enforcing immigration law. But there are a couple of other cases or a couple of other arguments that they make in their filings, which I can just touch on briefly. One is that they say that the inability of federal immigration agencies to access New York motor vehicle information can put the safety of those immigration officers and agents at risk. So basically, like, they're not able to say, they're not able to access or the criminal record data there to see if someone might be like a violent offender. What they said is that the inability to obtain this crucial information threatens officer safety by sending immigration officers into situations without information associated with the individuals they are pursuing or about to encounter. I should note that I do not think they've actually cited any examples of that happening, but nevertheless, that's one of the arguments they're making. They're also advancing a kind of constitutional argument, saying that this law is invalid under what's called the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, because, as they argue, it preempts federal laws, including a federal law called the Immigration and Nationality Act. The Supremacy Clause, civics reminder here, is a clause that establishes that federal laws take precedence over conflicting state laws. So they are arguing basically that this law, not necessarily the law that gives, not necessarily the portion of it that actually allows an immigrant to obtain a driver's license, but the provision that then blocks federal immigration authorities from accessing the database makes it unconstitutional due to the Supremacy Clause because it prevents federal officials from enforcing federal law.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And in other legislative news, specific to New York State, New York, the Assembly has actually passed a physician-assisted death bill. What does this mean now?
Yeah, so this is a bill that's been sort of bopping around without really much progress in Albany for about 10 years now. I think it was first introduced in 2016. This week it passed the Assembly, which is the first time it's passed either chamber in Albany. So this bill there's a couple of terms that are used to describe it. The supporters call it medical aid in dying. Opponents refer to it as physician-assisted suicide. The kind of middle path that we in the Associated Press have decided to call it is physician-assisted death. And it basically allows people who have a terminal illness and less than 6 months to live to obtain a prescription with the support, in this case, of two doctors, sign-offs of two doctors, that would allow them to die peacefully before their illness or disease, you know, ravages the rest of their body. So, like I said, it's the first time it's passed either chamber. And Dan Clark, our Capitol correspondent, who wrote the story, he spoke to the Senate sponsor, who said that there's still work to do to whip votes for it, but that she feels confident that they're going to get it done this year.
Wow. And you note here that if it does pass and is ultimately signed into law, New York would become the 11th state to allow assisted suicide. I'm curious, they say there's a little more work that needs to be done in the Senate. What about the governor? Do we know where she stands on this issue?
She may have said something about it in the past. I can't recall off the top of my head. It's never seemed close enough that it's the kind of thing she would have to weigh in on.
Right. And why would she if she doesn't have to?
Exactly. Yeah. I wouldn't really take anything that she said in the past super seriously about this particular bill right now. Yeah, as you said, it's the 11th. I think Oregon was the first state to do this maybe a decade or so ago now. A number of other states have sort of passed it. Just in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of advocacy on this issue at the state level, and it's the kind of thing that's starting to pick up a little bit of momentum in state legislatures across the country.
All right, Philip, we have literally just about a minute and a half to talk about this next story, but I do want to try to get it in quick just because I'm curious about some of our storied ski resorts in the Catskills, because they're facing, changing tourism trends, changing demographic trends, and climate change itself. So anytime there's a news update with these news resorts, I'm a bit curious. So what do you have about Wyndham Mountain?
Wyndham Mountain, the longtime president there, his name is Chip Siemens, president for 14 years. He has retired from that role, and he will become the chairman of Wyndham Mountain Club, which is the sort of current incarnation of the ski resort, and a Wyndham, the person who is taking his place, her name is Kristen Leach. She has been there. She was the director of membership. She previously sort of managed the club and golf course operations. She was actually born and raised in Wyndham. And, you know, this is pretty interesting because Wyndham is in the middle of this kind of major pivot to becoming a much more exclusive resort, really high fees, a lot of members only type stuff. So it's interesting timing, certainly. And we've got a lot of coverage of that on TimesUnion.com for people who would want to read more about what Wyndham Mountain's up to these days.
You took my next note right from me. That's what I was going to let folks know, that all the stories we've talked about and many more up now at TimesUnion.com. We've been talking to Philip Pantuso, Hudson Valley. Philip, thank you so much for joining us live tonight.
You got it. Take care.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Well, before we go on the local edition tonight, I do want to take a moment to acknowledge the fact that there is already a lot happening in our area. And, you know, it's just the first weekend of May here, but there's a lot going on, including at the Borscht Belt Museum over in Ellenville. They've got an open house that's going to be going on. It's happening Sunday going from 2 to 4. They say celebrate the museum's spring reopening. Have a nosh. Learn what's new this year. Meet our new operations director, and it's happening on Canal Street in Ellenville. And here to tell us more about it on the phone, we've got Andrew Jacobs, board president of the Borscht Belt Museum. Andrew, welcome back to Radio Catskill.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So you can have a little get-together this weekend.
Yeah, so the museum has been closed in the winter because, as some of you may know, we don't have heat, or we didn't have heat or AC, so we had to close the winter, but we are installing that as we speak, and we are reopening, and we'll reopen. This is sort of marks the beginning of us being open year-round, being a year-round institution, and we have the new exhibit coming. We have comedy shows. We have our summer festival, so we have a lot in store, and we'd love people to come by and meet some of our new hires.
Yeah, well, let's start there. That's what I want to ask you about, because you say, like, meet our new operations director. So, like, who are some of the new folks that are going to be helping you out this season?
Well, so up until now, we've been a volunteer-run organization, so it's a big deal for us to hire an actual paid person. Kate Napolitano, who works at the UFO Museum over in Pine Bush, and we also have a festival director, Amy Zaltzman, who comes to us from Storm King, and a few other people to meet. But, you know, for us, it's a big advancement from, you know, 3 years ago, we didn't exist as an institution. So to have an actual home and have a staff is a big deal for us, and we want to celebrate that.
All right. And so now let's also talk about, because this is the start of season, you do have big things coming up. When is this year's festival?
The last week of July, July 26th and 27th. For those who haven't been there before, Borscht Belt Fest is a weekend-long sort of food and comedy festival. We take over all of Ellenville for the weekend, and there will be talks and panels. There'll be about 24 comedy shows. We're expecting some big names in comedy to come down, a lot of food. A big street fair on Sunday. It's a good time.
And I don't want to shock people that we're already talking about something at the end of the July. We're just giving you a peek ahead, as it's going to be a busy summer, and we'll remind you, listener, about this again as we get closer. We're going to be talking about it a whole bunch on air. In what ways are what you're planning to do this year like the same as what you've done in the past, and what are some of the new things you might be trying to expand into?
So one new thing we're doing is we got a federal grant for our oral history project. We have over 125 interviews that we've done for the last 2 years, and we got a grant basically to sort of turn those into a sort of a public-facing exhibit. And what we're doing is we're selecting about a half dozen of those stories and snippets, and we have an illustrator who's animating them, and that'll be an exhibit. And then we also have another show that sort of highlights from our collection Since we started this project, we've gotten, you know, hundreds and hundreds of objects people have mailed into us, and some of them pretty exciting and incredible. And so we thought, let's do a little show that sort of highlights some of the cool things we've gotten. And, you know, that it ranges from, you know, a trumpet from, you know, a famous musician to a lot of, you know, hotel memorabilia, a tuxedo from Morty Gunty, a famous comedian, just sort of a real grab bag of items. And we thought it'd be fun to kind of show those off to the public.
It sounds like you're getting a real response from the public, and people are really engaging with this.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a rough time for a lot of people right now. And I think this museum is kind of dedicated to a very positive subject, which is the sort of Catskill Resort era, that culture, that period from the last century to the 1980s, where the Catskills was sort of the center of this sort of this leisure culture, and especially comedy, stand-up comedy. And sort of a lot of people respond to that. You know, it's a story about joy. And so I think we are kind of riding that need and that desire of people to sort of celebrate aspects of our culture that are worth celebrating, and comedy is one of them.
What you're identifying is, like, what's the living legacy of this time and place that you're focused on, and comedy is a big part of that living legacy.
Exactly, and I think, you know, and a big piece of that legacy is the sort of Jewish role in the evolution of comedy in America. And I think that's the piece of it that, you know, is very important to highlight, especially at this moment of what we're going through as a nation. And I think that piece of it is very helpful in sort of instructing how a minority group, a group that was marginalized, sort of, struggled to overcome discrimination. Because that's the only reason why the Catskills exist, because Jews couldn't stay at Christian-owned hotels at the turn of the century, the 19th century, that is. And so they had to create their own vacation land. And I think out of adversity, they created this very powerful, beautiful kind of phenomena of these stand-up comedy clubs all across the Catskills and all these hotels, which created, which provided sort of a venue for these meetings.
Yes, and it's an important time for us to be remembering and celebrating, you know, the contributions of Jews and Jewish culture to, you know, our local history, but, you know, our American history and our American culture.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And before I let you go, is there anything else that you wanted to let people know that we didn't get to?
I would say May 17th, we have one of our monthly comedy shows, the Borscht Belt Comedy Club, the monthly show we do at the Shadowland Stages here in Ellenville. So mark your calendar for that. We've got a great show. And just come on down on Sunday between 2 and 4. It'll be a fun day.
Yeah, again, this is the open house happening at the Catskills Borscht Belt Museum, celebrating their reopening, the start of the spring here, and going from 2 to 4 there at 90 Canal Street in Ellenville. And we've been talking to Andrew Jacobs, board president of the Borscht Belt Museum. Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, and good luck this weekend.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, big thanks to Andrew for talking to us. And thanks, as always, to Philip Pantuso of the Times Union. And thank you for being here. This has been the Local Edition. I've been your host, Jason Dole. And thank you so much for being here with me this evening. I'll be back, I guess, Monday night. Patricio will be here tomorrow because it's Friday. That's when he hosts the Local Edition. Hey, have you been to protectmypublicmedia.org? Have you done that yet? You should check it out. Protectmypublicmedia.org. And any internet-connected device, protectmypublicmedia.org, because the White House is planning to release a proposal that would claw back already approved public media funding. And if Congress agrees, well, this local public radio station, Radio Catskill, could lose critical support immediately, support that we were counting on to continue to bring you the news that we bring you every day here at Radio Catskill. So please save this local public radio station and stations like us around the country. Urge your lawmaker, whoever your representatives are, to do what they can to oppose the rescissions package. That's what we're calling it, the rescissions package. Get in touch with your lawmakers. Let them know. And for more information, you can go to WJFFradio.org. And we have links there to Protect My Public Media. You can also go to protectmypublicmedia.org. It's protectmypublicmedia.org. It's Thursday. We got a great local music lineup coming up at 7, starting with Ramble Tamble. But before that, we do have more news for you. It's on its way next. Stay with us for The Daily. This is Radio